Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Kozo Hattori, and I'll be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you for joining us. The purpose of these calls is to share stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our special guest is Claire Brown. Thank you again for joining today's call. Let's start with a moment of silence to anchor ourselves into the space. Thank you. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call. Today in conversation with Claire Brown. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Preeta Bansal, will engage in a dialogue with our speaker, Claire Brown. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and a circle of sharing, where we invite all your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point you can hit *6 on your phone and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. Our moderator today is Preeta Bansal, and I find that this is such a beautiful combination of moderator and guest because, you know, Claire's going to talk about Buddhist economics, and Preeta actually just in this last year stepped down from many of the important and lucrative, I'd say, and famous roles that she acquired through her lifetime of, you know, achievement, and devoted her time and energy to service. And I find it a very service and inner transformation. And I find it a very inspiring and unique, like it doesn't happen in daily life, in our daily life, the way we see it. So I'm so excited to hear not only the reflections of Claire Brown, but also how that reflects on with Preeta. So Preeta, thank you so much for your journey and your inspiration, but also for moderating today's call.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kozo. Thanks for that introduction. I'm really, really excited to be in conversation with Claire. Claire Brown is a pioneering economist who was one of the earliest tenured women professors in the economics department at UC Berkeley. Influenced greatly by exposure to racism and social norms surrounding gender while she was growing up in the American South in the 60s and 50s and 60s, she recognized that structural and social factors skewed the notion of choice and of well-functioning markets. She used an institutional approach to economic analysis. Her early research focused on employment disparities by gender and race, the role of unemployment insurance, and women in the workplace. Her later research focused on the global labor market for high-tech workers, the global competitive advantage of China, India, and the U.S. in the semiconductor industry, and the impact of education and immigration policies on engineers' employment and earnings. But we're here really today to talk about her latest contribution, which is a book she recently wrote called Buddhist Economics, which arose out of a seminar she's been teaching to undergrads. Claire graduated from Wellesley College with a math major in 1968, which is kind of remarkable for a woman to be majoring in math back in the 60s in terms of our traditional gender norms. She went on to receive a PhD in economics and has, as I mentioned, been a very pioneering economist at UC Berkeley. So welcome, Claire.
Oh, Priya, it's so nice to be able to talk to you today. I really admire all that you've done, and I really appreciate the whole idea of talking about awakening, because I think it's just so critical to all of us in figuring out how to live meaningful lives and also to give back to, just as you're doing. It's time, at some point you say, hey, it's time to really give back. We're so lucky to be able to do what we've done and then to help others.
Yeah, wow, that's beautiful. So I'd love to just start a little bit about, you know, talking about your journey. You've had, you know, you've been such a pioneer as a woman, as an economist. How did you get, and, you know, I was struck as I, you know, in your introduction about the fact that you were a math major in 1968. I guess just first things first, how did you get interested in economics back in that day when there many women weren't going into that field?
It's true, but, you know, I was so lucky to come of age at a time when the women's movement was really getting off the ground, when civil rights were really important and the country was making great changes and striving ahead. And I, coming out of the Deep South, I already knew that there was a serious problem with racism and discrimination. And I also saw all of our mothers who were well-educated and bright, talented women, all sitting at home trying to find things to do and with volunteer work and so forth to give their lives more meaning. And it just, nothing was making sense to me except that it was so wonderful in the late 60s. Everybody at that point in time, everyone in college really wanted to find a way to help make the world better, which was a wonderful time to be in college. The only downside was the Vietnam War. So we also learned about international relationships and what horrible things war could do to people. It was a great time to come of age and to try and understand what can we do in the world to make a difference.
Wow, that's great. And so how did you get interested in economics? I mean, economics is the study of the material world, of economics, of wealth. How did that move you?
Well, when I went to college, I knew how to do math. Math was so easy for me. It took no time. And any, like, taking English courses, I could barely survive. I really was terrible at English and writing papers. So I majored in math because it was fun. I could do it. And then that would give me more time to work on other things like English or history courses were also very hard for me. But I loved them. So I said, okay, I'm going to do math. All I have to do is go home and do all these proofs every day. No problem. I can do that. And then that gave me time to explore and to learn things that I really needed to learn about. And so actually, I did it because it was easy. I've got to tell you that I never thought of anything I did as trailbreaking. I did things because I enjoyed them, because they were easy to do, because life just unfolded that way. All I knew was that racism and sexism were really major problems, and I cared about that deeply.
Uh-huh. So tell us a little bit about your early encounters with racism. White woman growing up in the South. How did that infuse your consciousness?
Well, I was so lucky because I had a black maid named Nazarene who took care of me, and she was just the most wonderful, loving woman, and I was very close to her. So every day I would run down a half a block to the bus stop. She would take the bus because, of course, she couldn't afford a car. And we would walk back home together. And one day I noticed that she had on some sandals that were broken, and they looked really uncomfortable. And I said, Nazarene, why don't you buy some new sandals? Those look like they're worn out. I was about 5 or 6. And she said, Claire, I'm saving up my money. I can't afford them yet. And I looked at her and I said, Nazarene, I'm so sorry because you need new sandals. And she said, yes. And she taught me about racism early on. She said, you know, black folks, we don't have much money. We need more money. And I said, nothing. But I thought about that, and that really stuck with me. And then other things that we did together really stuck with me. For example, I went to see a Disney movie, Snow White or who knows what. Probably Snow White. It's like so racist. But I said to her, Nazarene, I just saw the best movie. You got to go see it. And she said, Claire, I can't go see that movie. And I said, why not? And she said, Black folks, we got our own theater and we don't ever get the good movies. We only get the movies that are really old and no one else wants. And once again, I was so shocked. It was like, oh my gosh. So Nazarene, just through her experiences, very gently and lovingly taught me about racism. And I was really grateful that she did that, because then I understood what was wrong with where I was living.
Wow. And so how did that influence you on your journey, educationally and professionally?
Well, one thing was I couldn't wait to leave the South. So I went, as soon as I could, I went north to college. But also at the same time, I could understand that women were really held down by not being able to work. White women, not to mention mm-hmm. the Black women could only be maids. But white women were pitied if they had to be a secretary or a school teacher or a nurse. Those were sort of their three jobs that I could see. For white women, I'm thinking, this is awful. I'm just going to vow to never, ever have to be holding to someone else for my livelihood, which meant a man. So I'm thinking, and the women's movement was just starting something, this is really important that women have the right to work and make enough money so that they're a partner in the family and not just a stay-at-home person who depends upon the man to bring home money. So that was also a really important part of my journey. So when I went off to college, I said, I really want to learn how to deal with racism and sexism. And that was the movements that were going on at the time in the country. And the reason I majored in math is I think it was easy for me. But I realized by talking to my friends in the dorm and so forth that math was really quite boring. And the friends I had who were in economics had great discussions. And I'm thinking, wow, that is so much more interesting than talking about math. No one wants to talk about math. How boring. So I started taking economics courses. And then I realized I want to be an economist. Economics can really help us solve a lot of our social problems, or so I thought at the time.
Mm-hmm. And so tell me a little bit about that. How did, back then, in your mind, how was economics helping solve social problems?
Well, at that time, economists were very directly saying, oh, what can we do in economics to, how's discrimination happening? How does it occur? What's going on in the labor market that keeps women in certain jobs at much lower pay? And what's happening to Blacks? What jobs are they in, or are they allowed in, and how do those dynamics work? And so when I went to graduate school, my thesis was focused on discrimination in the labor markets for women and by race, by gender and race. And it became real clear that these markets weren't working at all in terms of equal opportunity. And other economists were also working in this area. And so it became clear that we could argue, you know, these markets are not so-called functioning well. The markets are set up and they're structured to keep women in certain jobs and to keep Blacks in certain jobs. And both are inferior and pay a lot less. And there's no such thing as equal opportunity. And that's when they started passing national laws with the EEOC to demand that women and Blacks had to have access in the labor market that was much more equal. So, you know, it's been taking a very long time to even make those changes, but slowly they were made to some extent.
Mm-hmm. So I find this fascinating. I mean, your whole approach to economics has been looking at, you know, what's called an institutional approach, where you look at how social rules and customs or norms impact on so-called individual choice, which, of course, is the hallmark of free market economics. You mentioned that back then, which is what you know, as you're talking about your college years, you thought that economics was kind of the way to solve social issues, or the discussions were about solving issues. And you said, at least back then. Have your views changed about the role of economics?
Oh, enormously. Predicted day, I probably would never go into economics. And I even laugh with my students about that. And my undergraduates especially, they'll say, should we become an economist? And I say, well, let's talk about what you want to do. What do you care about? How would you do it? And if they start talking about social problems and dealing with, say, racism, sexism in rich countries. We're talking about how to deal with massive poverty in emerging countries. I say, I don't really think you want to be an economist. I think you want to be more interdisciplinary. I think you want to consider even political science, sociology, or public policy, that those are all places where they're much more integrated and can do much more in looking at these problems that you care about. And many of them then have come back and said, oh my gosh, you're so right. I couldn't do what you're doing in economics today. It's all like statistics. I said, that's right. Mm-hmm. It's basically become a field of applied statistics, which is not institutional economics.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit about, you know, you've been pioneering as a woman, as an economist in your academic research. Tell us a little bit about your turn from economics, and especially from neoclassical economics. Like what do you think, I guess intellectually as well as inside you, what started leading to that shift in your view about neoclassical economics?
Well, I actually never believed in neoclassical economics. Institutional economics is the alternative approach, mm-hmm. which was always what I've done. But what really happened in economics was when the Chicago School, which is really, really pushed neoclassical economics, they became the mainstream in the 70s, exactly when I was beginning my career. And so it was actually not a very good time to be an institutional economist. We were able to get some work done and so forth, but we were really a very minor part of economics at that point. And all the Nobel Prizes were going to neoclassical economists. So what has happened is that there was a large enough group of us who cared about inequality and racism and sexism that, and we actually were at MIT and Berkeley especially, and some at Harvard. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we had certain places where we were doing quite well. And then finally, I think the country got a little sick of neoclassical economists, or maybe it was just time to hand out some Nobel Prizes to some other place besides Chicago and their bailiwick. And so I would say that economics has done much better in being broader and caring more, especially about inequality, but with their over-reliance on data and statistics, we haven't done very well at coming up and having countries adopt policies that reduce inequality. Because as you know, Frieda, inequality has only been growing since the 80s. Yep. And so what are economists doing? We have all these studies. We know how to reduce inequality. We know what works. Countries pick their inequality. Why is the U.S. becoming more and more unequal? You have to ask that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so as an economist, I have felt, in one sense, that we've really failed. Look at our legacy, more inequality. And I hate to say it, but we're repeating that now. I feel the same way now, deeply affected by climate change and global warming. And I went around to a lot of my colleagues over the last few years, and I would say to them, are you putting global warming into your work? Because it's affecting everything that you're looking at and studying. And they'd look at me like, what are you talking about, Claire? And I'd say, well, you know, just like, how can you work on, say, education? Or how can you work on a distribution of income? How can you work on anything without thinking about the impact of global warming? Because it is affecting what you're looking at. And mm-hmm. many of them have said, I haven't even thought about it. And Claire, that's not like you to come up and tell me I need to think about this. Like, come on. And I say, well, let me know. And almost always they've been coming back to me saying, my God, you're so right. I'm not sure how to do that, though. And it's almost like economists are just so focused on a little bit of a problem without looking at the whole picture that, once again, we're sort of not getting moving us along like we should. And I'm feeling really distraught by that, because it's mm-hmm. like, as economists, we should make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So tell us a little bit about Buddhist economics, and how that differs from certainly neoclassical, but even institutional economics.
Right. Well, it's a type of institutional economics, Greta, but it's much broader in terms of, okay, let's not just think about social rules and customs of the labor market. Let's not just think about social rules and customs of the developing world. Let's just not think about social rules and customs of income distribution, but let's pull it all together because they're all interconnected. And then once you do that, and then once you also, and this might be the most important difference, once you ask, what's human nature? Then all of a sudden you're turning economics on its head. And one thing for me in terms of my own awakening was when I started practicing Tibetan Buddhism about 10 years or so ago, I really have thought a lot about, oh, what's human nature? And in economics, we assume people are selfish and egotistical, and that really is a really solid foundation for economics, no matter who you are, institutional, neoclassical. If you start off with people, you know, really care mostly about themselves, then sort of anything they do for other people, they expect a quid pro quo. Even in institutional economics, they think, oh, cooperation is, oh, because it'll help you over time. Mm-hmm. But in Buddhist economics, you can say, oh, people are kind and altruistic. What does that do to the model? And it totally changes it.
Mm-hmm. And how does it change it?
Oh, okay. I didn't want to go on too long because I love your feedback and comments. So basically, what happens is if you move from people being selfish to people being kind and altruistic, then all of a sudden you can redistribute income to make everyone better off. In the model where people are selfish and egotistical, you can't give money from Bill Gates to poor people without making Bill Gates worse off and worrying about that, but which is somewhat crazy, right? But that's actually what economists will tell you. Whereas if you believe that people are kind and altruistic, of course you want to distribute income from the rich people who are just buying stupid status items, which aren't really helping anyone, including themselves, and you give more to people really in need, food, clothing, shelter, healthcare, education, and then all of society is better off. And so finally you have a model where people, when they are, realize that they're interconnected and caring for each other, they understand that creating meaningful lives really trumps more income.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, I guess in the traditional economics model, a dollar more of income is a dollar more of income, and it doesn't matter if that goes to Bill Gates or to the poorest person. There's no qualitative differentiation in terms of the way the economists would view that extra dollar. Is that fair?
That's exactly right. It's like more is better, and more is better to anyone, no matter how much they have already, and whether they're starving in a developing country or whether they have no medical care in the U.S. or whatever the problem is, we ignore those problems. And in fact, in classical economics, it's the victim's fault. It's not society's fault. But at least in institutional economics, and certainly in Buddhist economics, it's society's fault that we didn't set up systems where people are cared for, as well as given the opportunity to do their very best to fulfill their potential, to give back to the community, because it all goes together. And so the Buddhist economy is really one that combines sharing prosperity as well as caring for and a sustainable environment, and then relieving suffering, helping others that are really the poorest and the worst off.
Isn't this in part a problem of measurement of economists? Like, short of embracing a completely new view of human nature, which some people, especially in the mainstream, might be reluctant to do, even if you believe that people are self-maximizing, utility-maximizing people, creatures, couldn't some of the problems or some of the big problems of economics be solved even without embracing a radical new view of human nature as interconnected? So I'm thinking, you know, just that problem we talked about the dollar to Bill Gates is the same as the dollar to the poorest person. That seems to me to be a bit of a measurement issue, where shouldn't we be looking at what that dollar is used to consume, whether it's basic food and housing versus the next luxury yacht?
Well, now you're going directly to Amartya Sen's work, which is an important part of Buddhist economics, where he won his Nobel Prize for saying, look, it's not income that tells us how well people are living and their well-being and how well society's doing. It's how people are living. And so Amartya Sen, based upon his growing up in India, said, you know, let's look at people's capabilities. Let's look at how well they're functioning. And let's measure that as our sense of how well the economy is performing. And, of course, that's exactly the approach that you were talking about. Let's look and see how well people are living. And so in Buddhist economics, we devote a whole chapter to saying, hey, let's measure economic performance as well-being and not as income. And by the way, every economist alive will tell you, income doesn't tell you how to measure well-being, even though that's all we do. We measure income or gross national product for well-being. We all agree we shouldn't do it that way, and yet nothing has been changing. We're still doing it that way.
Mm-hmm. So let's take just a basic question, like what makes people happy? How would traditional economics answer that question, and how would Buddhist economics answer that same question?
That's such a wonderful question to ask because it really shows the difference. So neoclassical or mainstream economics thinks happiness is hedonic, meaning you seek pleasure and you avoid pain. But it's all short term. You just, every minute you can, you're seeking more and more and more, even though it's short-lived. And all the studies show that. In fact, when you rush out and buy something, a game, some shoes, a new car, whatever you buy, it gives you a blip of happiness, of hedonic pleasure. But then you revert right back to your old level. And so that means you're going to be rushing out and buying more. And it's an endless cycle. So what Buddhist economics says is, hey, let's take a step back and go back to Aristotle, where Aristotle mm-hmm. said happiness actually it comes from knowing yourself and leading a worthy life, and a life that's meaningful and a life where you give back to your community. And he says, of course, and I like this a lot, Aristotle says, but of course, you have to have basic consumption. Everybody needs all the basics so that they're surviving well, so that then they can go on and ask, well, what's meaningful? How can I live a worthy life? And to me, that's like sort of at the heart of Buddhist economics. How can we live meaningful lives where we give back and we find happiness in the way that we're living?
Mm-hmm. So, of course, Aristotle was, you know, the one of the fathers of the Western philosophical tradition. And I guess, I wonder if you have any thoughts or insights as to why Western economics went so off track from that basic, broader view of happiness. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Claire, you're back.
I'm so sorry. I don't know what disconnected me. I am clueless. But, you know, that's sort of life, isn't it? Everything's so impermanent. We get connected and reconnected and disconnected.
Beautiful.
But we're always interconnected. We are always interconnected, even if we get disconnected.
Exactly. Beautiful. So I'm not sure if you heard. Yeah, I'm not sure if you heard my question, Claire. I was kind of asking about Aristotle and the fact that he was kind of, you know, it's interesting because your approach of holistic economics, which seems to me to be oh so sensible. I mean, how can we talk about happiness without a sense of the environment, without a sense of how the least of us are faring, or even most of us are faring? I mean, I think, you know, recent statistics say that eight individuals have as much wealth as one half of the world's population. So 8 people compared to 3 billion in terms of just wealth. It's extraordinary, that kind of income inequality. So what you're saying to me feels so intuitive, makes so much sense. And it doesn't, I guess, you know, why is this not more part of the Western tradition, given that Aristotle in some ways outlined this broader view of happiness?
Right. Or, you know, I even think, Frida, I love the way you stated that. I think also we have to understand the Western world is not homogeneous. It's like the Northern European countries are much more aware of the need for everyone to participate in shared prosperity. And so to me, I think, gee, why is the U.S. lagging so far behind, and like the U.K. also? And I think economists are clueless. We go back to Hicks. We love making our models super rigorous, and the minute you try and make your model mathematical, which we've done, then you really can't bring in social values. Otherwise, mm-hmm. the model doesn't have a solution. And so I think to answer your question, you really have to go to the political scientists who've done quite a bit of work on this, and then also sociologists. But economists, you know, actually, I hate to say it, economists in general don't read outside their field, and we just keep going along our merry way without being able to do a whole lot. I think that's why Thomas Piketty's work had such a big bang. He was really willing as a French academic to talk about all kinds of things and to bring them in to his own work, even though 500 pages was really too long. I don't really have an answer to your question.
Yeah, that's great. I call Thomas Piketty's book the book that everybody owns, but very few people have actually read.
or at least not past the first 50 pages.
Yeah. So you say in your, I want to go back a little bit to your you talked about being influenced by Tibet and Buddhism and in terms of your personal shift. And in your book, I think you say that, I love the way you framed it. You said, I've been an economist for a lifetime and a Buddhist for a decade. Tell us a little bit about your spiritual shift. How were you raised spiritually? What do you think led to or opened you to shifting to Buddhism and having what you call your awakening?
Well, I was raised as an Episcopalian and went to church every day. Actually, I loved church. I loved Sunday school. I had friends. I sang in the choir. But when I went off to college, I'd really had enough. So it was like, okay, finally, I don't have to go to church anymore. Even though my roommate also happened to be Episcopalian, too, by background, she agreed, oh, no more church, enough of that. And then I left college, and I was becoming an adult, I really cared about my spiritual life. I never gave up that. I realized how important spiritual life was to material life and one's well-being. But I never found a place that really resonated for me. I tried actually a lot of Zen Buddhism and other kinds of spiritual practices, but none of them stuck for me. I just, sort of didn't make it part of my life. But one of my graduate students who practiced Tibetan Buddhism in L.A., he's on the faculty at UCLA, he knew I was trying to find a place to practice some kind of spiritual life, and he said, Claire, I don't think you're Zen. They're too strict. You're Tibetan. You love to chant. You are you like something that's much easier and in tune with what's going on around you. He said, try Tibetan Buddhism. So I started trying it, but I still hadn't found the right exact teacher. Until one day, Frida, you won't believe this, one day a Tibetan Buddhist meditation hall opened up right in my neighborhood in an old Episcopal church.
There are no accidents in the universe. Yeah, right? There are no accidents in the world.
Yeah, so my husband and I walked in, we sat down, we practiced. We loved the teacher. He was really wonderful. And so we started, and also we could walk. And he laughed as a Jew. He grew up Jewish. He said, oh, finally, I can walk to Shul. Orthodox Jews are supposed to walk and not drive. And so we started practicing with Anam Thumkin. And then later on, when I became much more interested in integrating climate change and global warming into my practice, I've also reached out to other teachers who spend a lot of time working on that.
Wow, that's amazing. So in terms of your own personal journey and your professional journey, I guess in terms of the big questions that we talked about, like, what
you know, what leads to happy, what makes people happy, and how much is enough. How or did your personal answers change to those questions at all as you started shifting from kind of more mainstream spirituality to, let's say, Buddhism?
Well, I'm not sure if I fully comprehended what you were asking. So we might want to pursue it a little bit more. But personally, you know, I think things evolve over your career and lifetime. So that early on, I was really busy trying to get tenure, but also then raising my family. And so at one point in my life, I really cared about finding balance in my life, where work and family went together in some way, or at least didn't disrupt each other. But then once my kids left home and were off to college, I really stopped and thought, oh my gosh, I now have a lot more time without having to care for kids. And I said, what could I do? I felt it was give back time. I have felt so fortunate to have a wonderful job, to have been really well educated, to live in a beautiful place like San Francisco Bay Area. I have just felt so enormously fortunate and grateful. And so I said, okay, I want to figure out how can I give back and use my education and energy and experience to help the world and help other people. And so that became my focus. How can I do that? And that, of course, is a journey in and of itself, right?
You know, I think for a lot of people that's sometimes, you know, a pattern or a trajectory where we first focus on, you know, making our way in the world, getting enough material, comfort, achievement, family, all of that kind of thing. And then later in our lives kind of shift to the broader questions of meaning. At least for some people, that's a common trajectory. And I noticed that early in your career, you focused on, I think what you call the relative income approach, where people often look at what other people are making in terms of assessing how much is enough. And I guess this is kind of shifted, kind of moving more towards the social change type questions that I have. Given that we often measure ourselves according to our environment, how do we start creating change in those environments? How do we change the notion of what's enough when we're judging what's enough based on what everyone else around us has and when we can start giving back?
Right, that is such a wonderful question. And I think that, of course, all of this starts with ourselves in some way. You know, I was really lucky in that I never understood how to shop for clothes. My sisters knew how. I just never got it. I couldn't figure it out. And to be honest, I hated shopping. I couldn't stand shopping. And so once again, that actually turned out to be a blessing, because if you don't like to shop, you don't end up collecting a lot of crap in your house, or it doesn't take a lot of your time, right? And so in some ways, I was really lucky, although to be honest, I'm still don't fully understand how much pleasure people get from shopping, and that might help me to understand that better. And so for me, the relative income approach is so obvious. It's like, okay, especially I could see that raising kids. Oh my gosh, when they go visit those friends have this, that, and the other, my kids don't have that. But instead of saying, I guess we better chase after that, I'd sit down and say to my kids, you know, I see this and this and this, but like the kind of shoes or certain video game or whatever. I said, but you know, I actually am not sure it's worth the money. And we would talk about it. And often they would disagree and say, no, you don't understand. That's really important. Or other times they'd say, oh, you know, you're right. Who cares about that? But at least we would talk about it. And I would try to understand what was driving them, and they would try and understand and let me know why. And we would often come to an agreement. You know, economists love the concept of opportunity cost as well as relative income. So relative income, you're judging people ahead of you, and opportunity cost, everybody's saying, oh, with this $30, instead of buying that fancy pair, spending on extra fancy shoes, if I got plainer shoes, what would I do with that $30? And then you say, oh, I'm giving that up. Oh, no way. I'd much rather say, go out and have a nice lunch or whatever it is that you want. And so my kids immediately caught on to the idea of relative income, of rather opportunity cost. And I'd say, okay, if you have this much money for a game or this much money for whatever, what would you pick? And they knew. They knew right away. And I said, okay, so that's what we're going to buy. And they'd say, oh, okay, we get that. We understand that. Because we all know you can't buy everything. That's a basic rule of economics.
I'd love to ask you a little bit about, I'm going to come back to the issue of social change, so we'll kind of save that. But I'm going to ask you a little bit about your students. You've been teaching for more than 30 years. What are you seeing in the kind of next generation of kids and what they're interested in and what their, you know, what their concerns are? Do you see a shift to a more holistic economics? Is your seminar that you teach, is it viewed as well within the mainstream of the economics department, or is it viewed as kind of an alternative offering? Just love to hear a little bit about that.
Okay. And definitely we can come back to social change. I wish I had better answers on all of these. But, you know, I love exploring and discussing, so we'll just keep pushing in that direction. For the students, as well as social change, we go through sort of cycles. So then in the 70s, students were really into giving back and finding how they could use their talents to help others in the world. Then Ronald Reagan came in, and the world really changed. And all of a sudden, our students started showing up dressed up dancy. Forget, you know, coming in T-shirts and jeans. And they started doing designer labels. I mean, everything was almost appearance and showing off who you are and what you can do or get. And it was a difficult time. And the faculty talk about it. And one, I'll never forget, a colleague from the business school came in my office one day, slammed the door and said, I don't think I can teach anymore. All my students asked me is, what's the bottom line? And he said,
wow.
Just a second. You know, that's not the only thing we're caring about. I said, yeah, I know. I'm really so tired of my students in my labor classes asking, how can I make more money? What job should I get? And it's like, huh. Oh, no. And then finally Bill Clinton came along and things definitely got better. But I forgot Jimmy Carter, but that was during the gas oil crisis. But things did in the 90s get better. We definitely made tax a little better, but we didn't go nearly far enough. And we're still sort of in that place where the students come and go, and they definitely reflect what's happening in the broader country. So that when I was starting Buddhist economics, the students came in and they really cared about distribution and inequality. They were starting to learn about climate change and global warming, and they really did care about the emerging world. But now that Trump is in, I almost see a backsliding where the students are thinking, oh, are we supposed to put America first? It's like, oh, what do we get from helping Nigeria or Kenya or whatever countries, Botswana, whatever they're thinking about? They actually now ask that question, what do we get from that, instead of saying, how can we help? So I don't see it as a linear progression. I see it as coming and going and cycling around, and now I'm feeling like, okay, I've been here before. I know how we have to respond to get them to think about other people and compare themselves to them, which for me is one of the best things. I say, oh, well, let's compare your life to their life. And that's always an eye-opener.
Yeah, what's an eye-opener to me is how much the students reflect what's going on in the national, or and how quickly they seem to reflect what's going on in the national conversation. You say you're already noticing a difference in terms of the current, given the current political climate, you're already seeing that reflected in your students.
Yes, it's almost frightening, Preeta. And so one of the good things about Berkeley is we have some diversity of income and background, not nearly enough, but we have some. And so it really helps in a small class. Buddhist economics, I don't allow more than 20 students because it needs to be a seminar. And once the students get to know and trust each other, they share their stories so that the student who struggled a lot in their childhood explains what it feels like to be hungry. And that has a huge impact upon the other students who have never experienced hunger, who instead talk about, oh, my mom goes to the store and I can't figure out what to choose. There's so many choices. And so we'll choose several things, and I get to see which one I like better. And it's like, that is so far from ever being hungry. You know, it's the other side of the coin. But they'll share those things. And everybody then gets a much better sense of when they're really fortunate and when other people aren't, which might be the first step for them in thinking about how to help other people and not just think about themselves.
And you, I read that you start your course, your seminar on Buddhist economics with a little bit of silence and personal practice for the students and meditation. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit how you structure that?
They love it. They absolutely love it. We start with just 5 minutes. For some of them, it's an unbearable 5 minutes. You know, if you've never sat quiet, 5 minutes is a very long time, right?
Yeah.
And so I'll ask them, though, as I said, well, if you sit, the more you do it, and I said, and you can practice it in a boring classroom even. Just sit there and focus on your breathing and think about it. And they would start doing that. And then as the class went on, I'd say, okay, last class we sat for 7 minutes. How long would you like to sit today? And they almost always increase it. And
wow.
You know, I'll say, oh, let's go to 8. Or I say, okay, we're never going to sit longer than 10 in class because our class doesn't last long enough. But they also started saying they found moments to sit outside of class. I said, yeah, even 3 minutes of quiet time really will help you. And they'd come back and say that. You're right. It's astonishing how quiet time and internal reflection has really helped me. And so for many of them, that's their favorite part of class.
That's amazing. And tell, can you tell us a little bit about your personal practice also?
Well, once again, Frida, I am so lucky. I decided that I really wanted a little meditation hut. And we had a place in our garden where you could build a hobby room or a shed. And so that's what I did. I had a friend who, a contractor, but also an architect who for free just said, make sure that it was all the code. And it's 80 feet. It's 10 feet by 8 feet. And it's got a great big glass window that looks out over the San Francisco Bay. And so my hut is so special to me. It's so peaceful and quiet. And once it was finished, once it was built, it's all just made out of wood and natural materials. Anand Thumkin, my Rinpoche, came by with a llama. They just happened to walk by, and they walked up and said, oh, this looks like a new hut. And my husband said, yes, I was just cleaning up all the debris. We just finished it. And I came down, and I said, oh, would you please come in and sit with me? And we went in. There was nothing to sit on yet, so we just grabbed some pillows from the house. And we sat down, and I said, I was hoping to have my hut blessed. And Anand Thumkin said, well, we're so fortunate because this llama here is famous for his blessings. And he says, if you could just find some rice. And so my husband ran and got some rice, and they started chanting. And it was so beautiful. They chanted for like 10 or 15 minutes, and the whole feeling of the hut changed. They spread around the rice, and then they got up and they bowed and they left. And later I asked them, I said, can I do something that will wreck? I said, the energy in my hut is so beautiful. Well, if there's anything I can do to wreck it, can you tell me what it'd be so I'll make sure I don't do it? And he smiled. He says, it's okay. You can't wreck the energy that's there. Whatever you do, the energy is there. Just like your Buddha nature, it's all okay. You won't wreck it. And that was just a fantastic feeling. Yeah. So every day I go to my hut, and I'm there anywhere from 30. What I tell myself, I don't know, other people might be this way, say, oh, I don't have any time today. Well, I guess I'll go down for 10 minutes. And then easily it's 30. It's like I just need to get there, right?
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's remarkable. So I want to, I know there's going to be some other questions, and I want to leave some time for others, but I want to go back to kind of how do we bring about a shift to how do we plant the seeds toward this more holistic view of happiness? And I was struck by a line in your book where you said, most likely this book won't have enough rigor for some economists and enough dharma for some Buddhists. I am not writing the book for them. So I'm curious, not only with respect to the book, but your work in this current stage of your career, who is your audience? And who do you think needs to be open or receiving these ideas in order to bring about some shifts?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. You know, I wrote the book to generate discussions, just like the one we're having. And I appreciate everyone who's joining in with us. You know, it's interesting, the economists, most of the economists, the ones I talk to and know, really like this book. And many people who, economics professors have written, say, thank you for making your ideas for economists really clear. It's so hard to get some of these ideas and make them clear. Now, the non-economists find it, you know, a little bit tougher on the economics, but they find the spiritual part easier and relate to that. But the Buddhists have been wonderful. I haven't had one Buddhist complain that it wasn't deeply Buddhist enough. They'll say, oh, thank you for helping people figure out how to take the whole idea of interconnectedness with each other and with Earth and bring it into their daily life. And so the economists and the Buddhists have all been really supportive. And people in general have. I get the nicest emails or messages from people about thank you. Thank you for your book. So it made writing my book really worthwhile, just to reach out and touch people that way and to have them touch me. I guess the only people who I'm finding difficult, to be honest, are journalists from print media. They just ignore my book, or they say, oh, we don't do religion, or I think they're really scared about the idea of economic performance not being income growth, because they know how to report that. Mm-hmm. Oh, economic performance should be well-being for everyone and not average income? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? I'm not sure we're willing to go there. But that's been the tough hoe, but I don't think that's how we create social change. I think we create social change by first looking inward. And finding what makes us happy, what makes our lives meaningful, and then reaching out to the world. And then right now, all of us getting off the sofa and demanding, at the local level at least, that we do certain things to both help everyone, but also to help nature and to heal nature. Because climate change in the U.S., at least right now, depends upon the local level, while the national level is ignoring caring for Earth. But I think social change is happening, but it's happening first with people and then our reaching out to our communities and our states. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Claire, this is Kozo. We're reaching the top of the hour.
Oh, Kozo, I'm sorry. You were breaking up. Is there something I can do to hear you better?
Oh, sorry. Can you hear better? Is that better?
Let me see. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, Claire. Is my call breaking up?
Yeah.
Okay, now I hear you
go
a
ahead.
Little better. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to open up the phone lines. So if you want to ask a question or join the conversation or a comment, hit star 6 on your phone to be put into the queue.
I can't follow you. You're breaking up.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and say that. I think he's trying to say if you have any questions.
Is that better? I took out.
Yeah, you're still breaking up, I think.
Yes. So, Prita, can you just tell people it's star six on the phone line?
Yeah, so if you have any questions, I'll ask, before we get into my final question, we want to open up the phone lines and the audience for questions. So if you have any questions, push star six on your phone, or you can send an email to ask@servicespace.org, and you can also submit a question if you're watching through live webcast through the web form. So,
and I love questions. Questions are my very favorite thing to have.
Yeah, so we have a few coming in, but before we'll let a few more people kind of add their questions. But what I wanted to ask you, you were talking about kind of death change coming from within first and foremost, and kind of locally. You know, it's just interesting. You are more aware of this more than anyone, just given your background in institutional economics. It's this interesting dance between the inner and the outer world. On the one hand, you know, yes, we are very, we can make a lot of change through our own inner shift and our inner journeys and the way in which we operate in the world. On the other hand, our environments affect us a lot, our institutions, our social norms, the rules. And so I guess, you know, maybe one way to, there's so many ways we can approach this question, but one way, it, you know, you started mentioning this earlier, when students come to you and say they want to work on inequality, they want to work on the environment, they want to help shift the world ever so slightly, what would you tell them? What would you tell your younger self in terms of, you know, educationally, professionally, how to go about making...
On a personal level? Are you asking about, or both? Both the, you know, in Buddhist economics, we have inner wealth and outer wealth, and mm-hmm. you care about both, and they don't not go together, but the Dalai Lama always teaches us, make sure you don't only focus on outer wealth, because your true wealth is your jewels, your inner wealth. And so know yourself, and then you can reach out and know and help the world. And outer wealth isn't bad. So one of the things we talk about is I say, what do you care about most? What would you most like to do to help? And once you put it that way, they all of a sudden can focus, and it's no longer such a mishmash. And they'll say, oh, I really care about prisoners' rights, or I really care about women's reproductive rights, or I really care about children who don't get enough to eat. And once they put it that way, then they start to understand what dimensions of the problem might be important to them, because one of the things I always say to my students is education is learning to think well and clearly, but also education is a toolkit. When you leave here, you want to say, oh, what tools do I need to tackle this specific problem? And then you're like, oh, well, do I need to go to law school? Do I need to go to public health school? What do I need to learn? And what do I need to do next? And so all of those start to come together for them once they can ask a question about what do I really care about? What's really important to me? And then also in class, one of the things about inner and outer wealth is they'll talk to each other, and somebody will say, you know, I really don't care how much money I make as long as, you know, I have a decent lifestyle, but I really care about what I do with my life. And others will say, oh, no, I really want to make a lot of money, and then I can use it to help other people. But then they start dialogues with each other and pushing each other on what does that mean on what you're actually doing. And I love listening to them because the young people really know how to talk to each other and to push each other on what's important, how are you going to do it, and how are you going to live. And all of those are part of social change. Mm-hmm.
So we have a few questions in the queue. I'm going to queue up the next question from Aria.
Okay, I'm here. Thanks, Kozo, and thank you very much, Claire, and thanks, Prita. Claire, I have a question. In the 70s, I ran across the work of E.F. Schumacher and his essay on Buddhist economics and his book Small is Beautiful. And there were a lot of us in the Bay Area back in those days who were starting small businesses, and we were modeling our practice, our intention on Schumacher's ideas about Buddhist economics. I'm wondering if, you know, what kind of influence, if any, his early thinking about this has had on you.
Oh, well, I loved his essay, and I also read it in the 70s. And to be honest, when I read Small is Beautiful, Buddhist economics wasn't the essay that grabbed me, but his overall arch of how to live meaningfully and that more is not better. And I also at that point studied worker co-ops in small businesses, maybe even some of the same ones you were involved with. And much to my chagrin, they didn't seem to be able to scale very well, or even many of them weren't sustainable. And that was in economics my first really big disappointment, that the cooperative movement met the same end of a lot of the things I cared about with Ronald Reagan in the 80s. But Small is Beautiful had a huge impact on me. And as I say in my book, thank you, Schumacher, for even giving us the term Buddhist economics. And he had a big focus, especially on right livelihood or work.
Yes. Yeah, thank you. If I may, I'd like to ask a follow-up question that you sort of led me into regarding right livelihood. And back then, a lot of us were contemplating the question, how can I do my right livelihood, given my background, my degree or lack of degree or whatever it is? What is right livelihood for me? And my question to you would be, outside of your economic students, do you have any thoughts about, say, somebody who's been thinking about a career in, you know, in computer science or business or medicine or whatever it might be? What could be guidelines for a young person to choose, make choices in their career that's aligned with Buddhist economics?
Oh, I love that question. And in fact, I talk to a lot of young people at Berkeley who are in computer science and different types of engineering and social scientists who are exactly asking that question. So, of course, I guess the most important thing is, first of all, they're asking the question, right? It's like, thank goodness they're asking the question. But then the second thing is, these are really talented, smart people. And the minute you turn the question on them and say, well, think about it. In your work, how can you do something? So, for example, a young lawyer who was working at a major law firm to pay back his law school debts went and started working on a pro bono case to get rid of isolation for prisoners, so that they wouldn't be kept in, because so many of our prisoners were being kept in isolation, it was causing them severe mental and health problems. And he worked on that, and it got to his firm really got behind it, and he said, now it's okay, I can deal with my law work, because I have this pro bono case that's really important, and we're making progress, and they won. They really made a huge change, and this was in New York State, of getting rid of isolating prisoners. So many of them, to really get rid of that as a standard practice. And I see that I have engineering students who go out in the third world or the emerging world working on technology. And I say, okay, what we're training you to do is not to take your technology to the field, but go to the field and ask the users, what can you do? What's the most important thing right now to make an improvement in your life, in the way you live, the way you raise your kids? And that completely changes the way the engineers approach their technology or their problem. Just switching from thinking, oh, what's the best solution, to asking, oh, what does the user want? And so I see in these ways that these young people are finding ways to take traditional careers and making them much more meaningful, not just for them, but for the people they're serving.
It sounds like you're saying to sort of offer opportunities for people to engage with that question of how can whatever it is I'm doing be more meaningful to really make a difference from the people I'm working with or for.
Oh, you put it really nicely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Claire, I'm going to try to ask you from the web. If you have trouble hearing me, Krita said she'll jump in and voice the question. So this is related to Aria's question. And Hannah says, thank you, Professor Brown. I was wondering if you can shed light on money and the monetary system in our economy. I am starting a design business, but I'm having trouble accepting money from people. When I accept money, I can't help but think that more for me means less for you. I really don't like that, to the point that I'm having trouble maintaining clients. Thank you.
Okay. I had a hard time understanding the question. Priya, did you get his question?
I'll reread it for you. It says, thank you, Professor Brown. I was wondering if you can shed light on money and the monetary system in our economy. I am starting a design business, but I'm having trouble accepting money from people. When I accept money, I can't help but think that more for me means less for you, and I really don't like that, to the point that I'm having trouble maintaining clients. So I guess
what a beautifully sensitive person. It's like, that's astonishingly sensitive. And I can see how that could cause you a problem in our society. You know, I think probably, though, a lot of people that you accept money from may have more money than you do. So I think money in a lot of situations is pretty impersonal. But you're obviously talking about when it's a very personal interaction. And I'm not sure I have the answer to that. Krita, what do you think?
I mean, this is a big, alive question for, I think, a lot of people that offer, you know, deeply, as you say, personal services, but whether it's like yoga or even teaching the Dharma or anything, like, how do you intersect with that kind of attempt to spread, you know, new ways of being with accepting money and also the need to, you know, live in the world. So, you know, it's a great, I would love to get your thoughts on kind of the gift economy, how one goes about offering one's services, but in trust and trust that the universe will provide for you.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that I like about Buddhism is that it's okay to accept money. And, of course, giving gifts. And when one's doing personal services such as yoga or food prep or whatever it is that's helping people out, it's really important, I think, to understand that we don't just want to give gifts, but it's really, really important to accept gifts. And that people really do want to give back. And to realize, oh, this is their way of thanking me and of giving back. And it's not a matter of who has more, as long as everybody has, you know, adequate enough. But it's really a question of the interconnectedness. Oh, I give you this, I teach you this. Oh, you give me this back to help me. It's like, thank you for the interconnection. And so to me, the most important question to always ask is, did I do any harm? Is there anything I'm doing to cause harm? Because we don't ever want to harm. And so I don't think accepting gifts is causing harm, unless you think somehow it keeps the person from maybe eating or feeding their children. But that in general, it's really nice to accept gifts.
Mm-hmm. But I guess is it a gift if it has a price tag on it? So I guess I think of it as different. You know, I guess one question for me is it different? Is it more transactional if I say this is the price of my services as opposed to I will give you my service and I will accept whatever you choose to give me?
Well, many yoga teachers, for example, I know do that. They have a sliding scale, or even classes and so forth will have a sliding scale. so that people can adjust it to what they think they can afford, which I think is fine. That's certainly one way to make it less transactional.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller with a question. I'm going to queue up the next caller.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, hi there. Hello. Hi, Claire.
Hello.
I'm calling from London, England. I'm in London at the moment. And I was wanting to ask, I'm actually going to change my question now just from listening to what everyone was saying. Because I was at a festival a couple of weeks ago, and we were doing a workshop around it's called Conscious Law. It was around how to make law more conscious. And one thing that came up was this idea of transactional economics. And somebody mentioned this situation where there were teachers with school kids, and the parents were coming late to pick the kids up for about 5 or 10 minutes. And somebody had the bright idea, oh, well, let's make it that if they come in late, we'll penalize them by, you know, whatever the financial amount was, thinking that they'd all start coming on time. But actually what happened is that all the parents started coming even later and his answer was because they saw suddenly it became one kind of economy of a moral duty to pick up your kid to, oh, it's an economic transaction. Oh, if I come in half an hour later, I just have to pay £5 more. Okay, I'll just do that then instead. And it's an interesting thing about how you have these different economies, I guess, and it's almost a sense when you're talking about these different kinds of economies, and whether there are different ways of looking at how we can think of the economy as one is a transactional economy, and there's something around a moral economy, moral capital. Somebody had this idea of a moral capital or social capital, and just whether there is ways of, you were talking about math, you know, computer programmers or whatever, we could think of ways in which to be able to somehow get a sense of what this is, why we're behaving these other different ways, and when we confuse different types of transactions.
Right. And that story you just told, I know from reading Sam Bowles' book called Moral Economics, where he makes a big deal out of that story, just as you did, which is that parents were much they were able to pay for being okay. It wasn't. It was still very difficult. And Sam Bowles doesn't see the economies, but he talks about within any economy we have different types of transactions. And that, in fact, you don't want everything to go to the marketplace. And certainly Buddhist economics makes that argument. It's like, just a second, we don't want everything to go through the marketplace. We want to, oh, I'm back. I'm so sorry. I got bumped again. I don't know why. I love your question and example. But let me just finish up with what Sam Bowles teaches us, which I think is pretty important, which is that of course, we have market transactions. But we want everybody to be able to put their kid in school. We want everyone to respect and be polite to the teachers and respect the students and their needs, and that you can't put that, the respect and politeness through the marketplace. That has to be part of the culture of the school and the parents behaving appropriately. We shouldn't be able to buy off being rude. It's like, never.
Yeah. Did you want to follow up?
I missed part, I think, because the line was getting slightly good and kept dropping in and out, but yeah, it's exactly that but then it seems in England at least there is, everything seems to be shifting into or trying to be shoved down into the market economy, like with hospitals and everything else. It's like there's, even though we know this sense that we have to keep respect and so on outside of it somehow, and again I think you touched this at the very beginning, that you say that economists know that sticking to GDP isn't a good measure, and yet we still seem to be, everyone seems to be doing it. And why does that happen? Why isn't there a sense in the policy that we can't stick everything? There is care, and care can't be made into an economic market transaction.
That's right, and there are shifts going on. There are actually communities and states that are measuring economic performance differently. The OECD has the Better Life Index. The UN has the Human Development Index. A lot of states in the U.S. are using the Genuine Progress Indicator, and 17 countries have used that, at least some. So it's not like there's not a movement there, but I agree with you, it's not strong enough. And I think, once again, these cycles go, and I think with global warming, we're going to care much more about looking at well-being, not just of people, but of people and the environment, so that future generations might have a chance to live on the planet. So the global warming, to me, is one of the really big crisis events that's going to push us along to hopefully both behave better and with more respect and love for each other, but also for the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, just to follow up on that, on the word environment, I'm trying to set up a kind of my sort of legal kind of background and looking at ecological law, because the sort of the idea of that Schumacher College, and they have actually E.F. Schumacher was mentioned there, ecological design thinking, and the idea was that the ecology, when you look at the environment, it comes from the economy. The environment is part of the economy, but when you look at the ecology, then the economy is part of the ecologies of self and earth and everything. You know, and it kind of really shifts my worldview when I see that the ecology is nesting everything else, and myself, and then it kind of includes myself then, because I look at my own ecology and my own self through my own sort of meditative practice, and seeing how when I approach everything through ecology and systems, it kind of really changes a lot of things for me, and particularly around shadow as well. Around, like, one of the things, I think one of the questions was with students when you were saying, you know, I want to be etc. etc. I remember some of the things that I wanted to be was to do with things that I felt very angry about in myself. And so it was always coming from this place of, I want to save this world, I want justice, da, da, da. But as I looked at my anger and found where they came from and integrated that, it came, the questions of what I wanted to do came from a different place. And that to me also feels a very important shift to have, to be able to bring self and work into this circularity, a circular way of working. I don't know if that fits into a question so much, but just this idea.
No, but that was really nice. I loved what you said. But I think it's really important that you mentioned ecology, because ecological economics is a cornerstone of Buddhist economics. And a lot of people don't understand environmental economics is not what we are doing. Environmental economics is a basic trade-off. They think, oh, nature, we dominate nature. We use nature for our own consumption, which is the opposite of what you said around ecology. And so one thing about Buddhist economics is we have to put aside the idea that nature exists for humans, and we realize, oh, we're all interconnected with nature, as you said. And that completely shifts the way that the economy works, by automatically caring about what we're doing to nature now and in the future. And as you mentioned, that completely shifts our worldview of how we're living.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Claire. We have one other question I think we have time for that came in on the web, and I just want to read that because I think it really goes in some ways to the premise of economics and kind of questioning the premise of economics. The person says, I'm wondering if income isn't just inadequate to measure well-being, but also may inhibit well-being because it causes disconnection. And they say, I'm thinking about Dr. Keltner's study of how wealthier individuals have less compassion. Also gated communities and isolation in higher income communities. It's hard to get to know your neighbor if they're a mile away on a 9-acre lot. So I guess I'm viewing this comment or question as kind of, in some ways, questioning the premises of even measuring income as a measure of well-being. And I wonder, to me, that goes to kind of, you know, Claire, we talked a little bit about gift and accepting gift. What do you think is, what do you think is the relationship between wealth and well-being?
Well, I think
material wealth, yeah.
And I know Keltner's work. I love Dashner Keltner. He wrote a very nice thing about my book, so thank you. But this is a great question because it does go to the heart of Buddhist economics. So we think that everyone needs the basic necessities for a comfortable life. And we also know that when you get too much income, you become grasping and attached to it. And we know that that will actually make you unhappy. And isolating yourself is the worst thing you can do to become happy in Buddhist economics, because you're separating yourself, you're using your money to show that you're superior and you know, pushing everyone away, and that leads to unhappiness. So that you just put your finger right on it, but I don't see it as income is necessarily bad, in that the distribution, the use of income is what we really care about. We want to give everybody comfortable lives and a chance to fulfill who they are and what they can do. And we don't want to give all this money to rich people to separate themselves and grasp after more income and to keep chasing who they are and to show they're superior, because that's definitely making society worse off as well as making them worse off. And I think that goes to the heart of Buddhist economics, that we're all in this together. We all want to be happy. We all want to enjoy life. And we, in fact, can. But we have to do it together. And we have to really care for Earth as we're doing it.
That just, I hope you can hear this, Claire. That just reminds me of all the suffering and disconnection that's going on in the White House right now.
Yes, I absolutely agree, and I don't think the White House is a place of happy people, and it's in the mean spirit that what's happening to cause us to be more mean spirited is really upsetting me, because it's causing a lot of unhappiness and suffering. And I think, though, that as individuals, we can come together and continue our journey, and not let ourselves be driven apart by what's happening at the national level, especially at the White House. We can do it together. We can still keep moving forward together.
Beautiful.
Fabulous. Well, Claire, we always like to end with one question to the guests, which is, how can we as a community, a service-based community, which is a global ecosystem in many countries of, you know, how can we support your work further?
Well, I would hope everybody will read Buddhist Economics and send me your thinking and your thoughts. That would be wonderful. And then to remember that the entire Earth is all interconnected, and that we don't just care about what's happening in our own country, but we care about every single person around the world. And I constantly say this Buddhist prayer through the day: may we heal the Earth as we heal ourselves for the benefit of all. And together we can. I know we can move forward and make life meaningful for everyone.
That's so beautiful. Thank you so much. Just reflecting back on some of the nuggets from the call, you've given us a lot of food for thought. You talked about how the heart of Buddhist economics is, how can we live a worthy life? And that income doesn't tell you how to measure well-being, that as economists, by trying to make our models rigorously mathematical, we sometimes leave out social values. So a lot to chew on. We're really grateful for your insights. We're grateful for your work. We're grateful for your pioneering spirit and your kindness and presence and friendship with us. So thank you so much, Claire.
Oh, and I'm really grateful for this wonderful discussion. So thank you, Krita. And thank you, everyone who joined in.
Great. So what I'll now do is just we'll invite everyone to hold a collective minute of silence and gratitude. Let's do that. So thank you again, everyone. Thank you, Claire. And thank you for bearing through some unusual technical audio difficulties today. But it was a wonderful call, and we'll look forward to spreading it through our networks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.